Maybe you don't have any of their works in your music library, but you might have heard of the hip-hop duo called Insane Clown Posse. Catchy name, and one Matt Taibbi borrowed and modified for his book, Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. Matt Taibbi's a contributing editor for Rolling Stone, winner of the National Magazine Award in 2008 for columns and commentary, and the author of four other books. Those include The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Matt joined us nearly 3 years ago to talk about that book, so it's a welcome back, Matt. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me back on.
So in your wildest dreams back then, and we're talking about April of 2014, did you foresee anything like what has transpired?
No, not even close. I think like most people, at the beginning of this campaign season, I thought Donald Trump was an amusing novelty if he was going to enter the campaign, but that eventually order would restore itself and, you know, you would get the same kind of conventional campaign that we've had. But, I did see some preconditions that would have led you to expect that this could happen, but, certainly didn't see this happening. No.
Were some of those preconditions the grumbling about the, oh, my God, we're going to get another Clinton versus Bush race, that sort of thing?
I think there was just widespread dissatisfaction and resentment about the campaign process, and there was a lot of pent-up frustration on both sides of the aisle, among Democrats and Republicans, about the way that the process was not responding to the concerns of ordinary people. I think on the Republican side especially, there was a general feeling that the media was against them, that they were not telling them the truth. And I could see that somebody, if they came along and they were smart enough to make the process part of the conspiratorial picture and turn villains, turn us in the press into villains, that would be effective. And Trump really did that. He was really the first person to clue in to the idea that you could make the media and the donor class and the two major parties, you could lump them all together and make them into enemies that could galvanize voters.
Well, and in fact, it was in your other book, The Great Derangement, that you talked about lack of faith in the media playing a part. So, I mean, is it lack of faith among people who just think the media don't tell the truth?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I wrote that book 10 years ago, so I had worried a long time ago that people were losing faith in the conventional media, that we were no longer debating a commonly accepted set of facts. In the old days, of course, we had the three networks, and if the three networks said a thing was a fact, then everybody believed that it was a fact. Now, it's not the case anymore, and that isn't necessarily a bad thing, but what we do have is an atomized population that everybody consumes media in their own fashion now, and they have their own news sources, and facts are not necessarily facts. Now, Donald Trump has sort of ushered in this new era where facts are basically a consumer choice. If you like one set of facts, then there's going to be some media out there that will support your point of view. And he exploited that. He exploited people's distrust of the media and said, here's an alternative reality that you might prefer, and people did prefer it.
It was really a matter of time, wasn't it? I mean, you could see, even when Newt Gingrich was part of the presidential primary process, that all he had to do was say, well, you guys in the media, and he'd get a big howl of approval from the audience. So it seems like Trump just took the Gingrich ball and ran with it.
Of course, of course. People hate us in the media, and, sometimes for good reason. I mean, we've gotten a lot of things wrong. And also, there's kind of a class issue here. I grew up in a family of journalists. My father was a reporter, and I remember my child was like the movie Anchorman, basically. and when I was a kid growing up, reporters were not necessarily people who went to college. A lot of them were kind of from the Seymour Hersh model. They were people who had been in the business since they were 16. My dad was another person like that. He started working when he was 17. And now the community of journalists has kind of changed. There's a lot more people from, the Ivy Leagues who are doing this job who become campaign reporters. Whereas in the old days, there was kind of a general mistrust of all politicians and of power in general. They were more iconoclastic, I think. And that's not necessarily the case now. I think there's a tendency among reporters to feel simpatico with people in power that isn't necessarily the case. Wasn't necessarily the case before.
Although there's certainly a flocking to beat down some candidates in the early stages of the process in the primaries, and you talk about the seal of death as delivered by the media. Our Howard Dean, probably in 2004, one of the best cases that you cite.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly. I have a friend, somebody who I used to talk to on the trail a lot, and he had a nickname for this process that we called the Seal of Death, and that's basically when a candidate stumbles and the media just does this pig pile and there's an avalanche of negative news, and we all in the press, we know what the script is after that. You know, if it's Howard Dean's scream, or if it's Gary Hart getting caught on the monkey business, or, you know, some other scandal, first there's two or three days of relentless negative coverage, and then eventually there's the humiliating public apology, and then there's this grace period where the candidate stays alive for a little while, and then eventually there's the quiet exit. And we all kind of expected, I think, when the John McCain scandal happened last year, or 2015, when Trump said that he preferred people who were encaptured, we thought that was a seal of death moment. I mean, my friends kind of they were joking amongst themselves, saying, okay, it's time to roll out the script. And he defied it. And that was amazing.
All right, we'll get into the how he defied that, particularly because when you look at the way things flipped around here, the statement of condemnation from the Republican National Committee came from Sean Spicer, who now works for Trump as the White House press secretary. So a lot of ground to cover just in that particular incident, and much more to talk about in general with Matt Taibbi about things he saw on the campaign trail in 2016. His book is called Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. We'll come back and talk with Matt and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Matt Taibbi, longtime contributing editor for Rolling Stone, brought in a bunch of dispatches from the 2016 campaign trail and has assembled them anew in a book called Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. Judge by the title that Matt, as usual, is not pulling many punches in here. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about what transpired in the election campaign leading up to November of 2016 and what might happen now. 800-838-3760 to come in by phone. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. So we're talking about the seal of death that the media tend to deliver on political campaigns, like Howard Dean with the scream in 2004. And that it seemed like Donald Trump had that moment when he criticized John McCain for being captured, that he didn't consider John McCain a war hero because he was captured and held as a prisoner. And, you know, you can't drive up an interstate highway for more than about 20 miles in this country without seeing a sign about some community honoring veterans. So how was he able to turn this into a positive or just not make it a negative?
I think it had a lot to do, again, with the resentment towards the media and basically the sort of political establishment in general, because people, they don't like the idea that we get to decide who gets to be a candidate or not. The idea that we in the press sort of collectively decided that Howard Dean wasn't fit to be president and we just wipe him out, or somebody like Gary Hart or whoever. On the other side, sometimes it's more of a slow seal of death. Sometimes we just dismiss a candidate, somebody like Ron Paul, who doesn't have the right look or the right political attitude. We just don't take them seriously. And people deeply resent these judgments that the pundits make about candidates. And I think what happened with Donald Trump is they saw for the first time somebody who was not going to go along with the script. He didn't apologize to us. Not only did he not apologize, he just denied that it even happened. He said, "I never said that. You know, I believe anybody who, you know, gets captured as a hero." And we didn't know what to do. You know, I'm including myself in that generally, but the press just did not know how to handle that character like that. And they love the idea that he was defying conventional wisdom because they wanted somebody who was going to shake things up and change the way things were.
Well, the press is still wrestling with this. I mean, obviously, we're just less than a week into the Trump administration, but there was a fairly lengthy discussion on Morning Edition on NPR this morning with the news chief and Steve Inskeep and one of the reporters about why they don't use the word lie. Her inbox was filled with people saying, "Why don't you say he lied?"
Right, right. Well, I mean, I'm kind of two minds about that. Obviously, if somebody lies, the press should say, well, that's a lie. But it also plays right into Trump's hands when we do that, because I think what happened in the last couple of years is Trump has this tendency to make everybody in his orbit behave the way he does, which is like a character in a reality show. And reality shows thrive on conflict, and Trump has radicalized all the conflicts surrounding him. And the press has gone from a posture that of at least superficial detachment to one of just open hostility toward him. And maybe that's appropriate, and maybe they should, you know, use language that is more more graphic and leaves less room for doubt and more unequivocal. But the problem with that is that when we do that, when we start doing that, and we start saying he's a liar, then it confirms the narrative that he's selling, which is that the press is against me. So it's a tough call. I think you have to approach this matter with some subtlety. And I don't know exactly what the solution is. You just have to make sure that I think that the attitude in those headlines where you call things lies is a little bit dispassionate. And I think that's what's worrying me now is that's kind of not the case.
Well, the NPR reporter explained that she went to the Oxford English Dictionary, and what stuck out in the definition of lie was that there's intent. And because she can't read minds, she doesn't know what the intent was there. I understand that. But I wonder, you know, what you were just talking about, it requires some subtlety, but we are, you know, in the media, this is not a subtle environment anymore, and yet we're still trying to be the ones who are, you know, using nice words and being grown-ups about the whole thing.
Well, yeah, but again, I think what happens when and I hear people saying things like that all the time about a variety of issues, like for instance, you know, Fox News is openly political in its reporting, right? They don't even attempt to have any real balance in their coverage most of the time. And you hear people say things like, well, you know, why should we disarm? Why should they be the only ones who do that? Well, because they're wrong to do that. You know what I mean? I think we shouldn't abandon our standards just because people on the other side do. And I think that's what happens a lot with Donald Trump. He's made people so upset, and he's aroused such powerful emotions that you have otherwise rational people saying, well, if he's going to do this, then I'm going to do that too. And I worry about that. You know, the New York Times said he's such a unique figure that we should change our journalistic standards. Well, you know, then he's right about us if we do that. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's the concern.
Yeah, if you change what you do because somebody has thrown a new process in, it definitely changes what you're doing. Matt Taibbi is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. So let's go to what the chapter you call the GOP clown car in Iowa in the summer of 2015. I mean, here's another case where somebody said something that was certainly outrageous on its face. Mike Huckabee talking about the March to the Ovens. Did he pay for that?
Did he get paid for that?
No, I mean, did he pay for it politically?
No. He scored doing that, and Huckabee, I think, was one of the few candidates in the race who understood the new dynamic of political campaigning, which is that all attention, negative or positive, is basically value neutral now. You just need attention in modern politics. And he said that at a time when Donald Trump was just wiping everybody out, and he was getting oceans of free coverage, and that was making everybody else look small. And Huckabee succeeded just for a moment, you know, in stealing some of the thunder away from Trump and getting some free coverage, even though a lot of it was negative, and it boosted him in the polls a little bit. The only problem, and I don't think it was a coincidence that Huckabee has extensive television experience, unlike a lot of the other candidates. He understands that, you know, the modern campaigning is really just a TV show, and you just have to be good at it. You have to be a good TV reality character, and Trump is just happened to be better at it than Huckabee is.
So in that environment, then, a candidate is really encouraged to be outrageous.
Absolutely. I think Trump changed the dynamic of campaigning. He made it more about celebrity than about wrong or right or about policy or anything else. And what he really tried to do was sort of win the battle the same way that TV reality characters win. The idea in a reality show is to get as much screen time as possible and to be the most outrageous character and to win hits and eyeballs and ratings. And Trump does that. He does that better than all the other candidates. He took you know, what was essentially a boring television show that was going to star people like Scott Walker and Lindsey Graham, and he turns it into a gripping, engrossing, disgusting, perverse television reality show that nobody could take their eyes off, even if they hated him. And he understood that ultimately this would be to his benefit because he won all the votes that he could possibly get.
Matt, do you think that the math worked in Donald Trump's favor, too, and the fact that the field was so big, it was
Absolutely.
Easy for him to stand out? Yes?
Absolutely, yeah. I think the Republicans made a huge mistake in not having a strategy going into last year. They basically left it an open competition, and what happened was they split the vote up. Trump had a fairly insoluble plurality of support, somewhere between 25 and 35% in all the primaries early on. But he was splitting up. The remaining candidates were splitting up their vote, and if Rubio hadn't been getting 15 or 20%, and Cruz, if it had been one on one, the old guard Republican Party might have won out somehow if they had had a real front runner, but they didn't. They left this ridiculous, chaotic situation, and he exploited that for sure.
So you write that in a perverse way, Trump has restored a more pure democracy to this process. How do you see that?
Because Trump, he got over a lot of the traditional obstacles that kept outsiders out of the political process. And in the past, you needed the assent of the news media on the one hand, the political donor class on the other, and then one of the two political parties had to support you. If you didn't have the support of all three of those groups, historically, you haven't been able to win the nomination. And that was, I think that's a little bit undemocratic because it concentrates power in the hands of a very relatively few people. And Trump circumvented all three of those obstacles. Not that he, of course, he was self-funded for the most part. He didn't rely on the same donors that political candidates have in the past. So even though he was, in my mind, the wrong person, he certainly proved that an outsider could penetrate the process. And this, incidentally, is the same lesson that Bernie Sanders took from the process. I mean, he told me personally that, people should look at what happened with Trump and say, well, this proves that you can achieve, ordinary people do have power in the process, and they should be encouraged by it.
Matt Taibbi, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a contributing editor for Rolling Stone. His latest book is called Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You were just talking about Bernie, and in fact, in the section where you're talking about the media's role in all this, you point out that even though Bernie's was the insurgency candidate on the Democratic side, as was Trump's on the Republican side, he got far less coverage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bernie got, according to one study, he got 23 times less airtime on the networks than Donald Trump did in the primary season, even though they had comparable levels of support and actually won close to the same number of votes during the primary season. And that is purely, I think, a financial thing. Donald Trump got ratings and Bernie Sanders didn't. And then there was the additional factor of, if you're a news director and you work for one of the big networks, if you decide to run a Bernie Sanders speech in its entirety, there's a little thing in your mind that says this is a political act, right? You're kind of brainwashed in this business to stay away from certain kinds of politics. And Sanders represents a very serious kind of politics, whereas Trump, he's a ratings getter. So people rationalize giving him all that time because it was good for business. And I think that's the reason that he got all that free coverage.
And it was the president of CBS, wasn't it, who said, I don't know if this is good for America, but it's certainly good for CBS.
That's right. Les Moonves sort of infamously said that. And we were all guilty, in some respect, of taking advantage of the fact that Trump got attention. He was a gold mine for media companies, and that's on all of us.
Okay, let's take a call here from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matt Taibbi.
Thank you. First of all, I'll tell you, I'm a Democrat. I voted for Clinton. But here's my question for you, sir. This is the first election that I ever remember where there's so much protesting and people pissed off. 8 years ago when Obama was elected, I have a lot of conservative friends, and they were upset about it. But I don't recall them going into the streets and destroying cars and breaking plate glass windows like in Portland. what's going on? I just don't, I don't understand it.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, that's a great question. Again, I think Trump, I don't want to blame all of this on him, because it's clearly not his fault that people are rioting in the street and you know, acting in a certain way. But I do think that there was a stridency about this campaign that was different from all political campaigns in the past. People, maybe it's the internet, maybe it's the way people behave toward each other on social media. There's an emphasis on conflict. There's much less emphasis on, you know, trying to get along and trying to come to resolutions. People like to show their anger now, and that's just part of our political culture. And people are extremely angry about Donald Trump. I'm not sure that it's productive. What's going on right now? You know, I think if anything, it might even help Trump's cause a little bit. Some of the images and some of the sound bites that came out of this past weekend.
Well, you know, I would draw some parallels with the Tea Party, though, although they're not as physically violent. But also, I don't know that a few people breaking windows in Portland makes a whole movement.
Oh no, of course not. Of course not. And of course, we overrepresent every tiny little episode. And you know, every time if one person sets a mailbox, you know, a newspaper box on fire, that's what all you're going to see on TV, as opposed to a million people marching peacefully. But I do think the tenor of the anti-Trump movement is different than, say, the anti-war marches against the war in Iraq in the early 2000s. There's an anger and a confrontational attitude that's a little bit new. I don't know. The marches in the earlier part of the century, international answer marches, they just seemed a little bit more, for lack of a better word, they were more like the 60s peace, love, and understanding vibe. This is angrier, and maybe that's just because people just feel more hopeless now than they did back then. I don't know.
But did you attend any of the marches yourself or observe any of them?
I certainly went to all the anti-war marches.
I'm talking about this past weekend.
Not this past weekend, no, but I've seen lots of anti-Trump marches in the last couple of years. I mean, I certainly saw a lot of that. Saw a lot of it at the conventions. I made it a point at every Trump event I attended to try to go out and check out what the scene was outside, because this year, unlike many previous campaign years, there was a concerted effort to keep protesters out of the halls, so you really couldn't measure the level of discontent at an event inside the event as well as you could in the past. So you had to go outside and check it out, and I made it a point to do that.
That is quite a bubble you describe, though, on the campaign trail, where it's basically this codependency, it seems like, between candidate and media gaggle.
Yeah, absolutely. It's designed so that you go from the bus to the plane to a bus to the event and then back to the plane again. And while you're at the event, you're mostly behind a rope line. And if you've ever been to these, you know what it's like. You're usually in the rear of the event, and there's a riser where all the camera people are up on the riser, and then there's another little section where the press gets to do its thing. But you're almost like, you know, animals in a zoo. And once the Secret Service gets involved, it's literally like a zoo, because you're not supposed to break the security line, and you're supposed to stay behind the line with all the other people in the plane, and that includes the candidate and the candidate's aides and so on. So you're with the same people over and over again for weeks or even months at a time, and I think what happens is you start to adopt each other's values after a while.
Let's take a call from Sig in Gold Hill. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matt Taibbi, the author of Insane Clown President.
Hi, yes. I just want to explain. I am a naturalized citizen, immigrated here from Germany about 60 years ago. I am definitely liberal in my policies, and I would like some psychological support. I am so dismayed and so feeling so hopeless, because nothing seems to work. When the thing about the lying, Trump goes on and says he had the biggest crowds ever, and then they put two pictures on with Obama's inauguration and his, and it's clearly a lie, and it doesn't seem to make any difference. They interview Trump supporters right after that, and they're 100% behind him. This is hopeless. There's no chance of us getting through, because so many people seem to be just completely tuned out and so stupid. I'm sorry.
All right, let's give a chance for response. Thanks for that, Sig.
Yeah, no. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I think we're entering a pretty dark and confusing era in our history, and this whole question of, like, people choosing, you know, facts almost as a metaphysical or a consumer choice, it's bizarre. We've never had to confront anything like this before, and I don't know what the answer to it is, but you're right. Until we fix it, we're in trouble.
All right, much more to talk about with Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone, where he's a contributing editor. His latest book is called Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. We'll come back and talk more with Matt and take some questions and phone calls from you by phone call or by email. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Matt Taibbi and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Matt Taibbi, a longtime contributing editor for Rolling Stone, winner of a National Magazine Award in 2008 for columns and commentary, the author of four books. And number five is Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about what led up to the election of November 2016 and what we have gotten as a result of that election. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Fair number of thoughts about the media here, obviously. Let's take another one from Rich in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning.
Hi.
You know, the media created this guy. You know, they have to own it now. I mean, seriously, they have to own it and admit that they screwed up. And, you know, I mean, you guys are the fourth estate. And if we can't depend on the Fourth Estate to hold political leaders accountable for the things that they do and say, then, you know, there is no – I mean, it's another chip at democracy that's just going out the window. And we've already had enough of that. And to me, in my personal opinion, is I think it's corporate that actually dictates to the media how and when they report things. And and it's been going on for the last 50 years, at least.
All right,
you know,
so
longer.
Let's get an idea from Matt about what he thinks about this. Thanks for that, Rich. Appreciate it.
Sure. Rich, I mean, on the one hand, I agree with you. I think we are responsible for Trump's rise in a couple of respects. I think the biggest one is that he got so much free coverage when other candidates had to pay for their coverage, and that was it purely had to do with the financial realities of the business. You know, regardless of how people lean in their politics, reporters, we most of us work for big nihilistic money-making corporations, and they need ratings in order to survive. And even though in the old days, you know, the news was supposed to be a loss leader, they weren't responsible for making money. They relied on sitcoms and sports to make money, and this is how we did a service for the community. Well, we don't do that anymore. That's not how we view the news business, and that's unfortunate. And I think you're right. I think the new attitude of news as entertainment was a major factor, and Trump exploited that because he made a bad entertainment show into one that was, that got incredible ratings, and that's how he succeeded.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, too, is that even news outlets, or at least information outlets, you can't necessarily call them news. I mean, I'm talking about The Daily Show and liberal mm-hmm. blogs and stuff like that. Even though they profess to not stand a single thing about Trump, they showed his picture so often, you got the impression after a while the guy was already president.
Right, exactly. And then there's an unconscious effect that has on people. You know, for instance, if you watch the first debates, the Republican debates, Trump almost looked physically bigger than all of his competitors. And of course, he is a big guy, really, but he had a gravitational pull on the cameras. He got more airtime and more camera time, even – on stage with other candidates, and it was just organically because the size of his celebrity was so significant. And that has that's a message to people unconsciously that this person is more substantial than the other person, and that has to do with the amount of coverage the person gets, whether it's negative or positive.
Yeah, and I remember Gary Trudeau too, the author of Doonesbury, which is just doing new strips on Sundays now, talked about the fact that his editor finally said, you know, you can't do Trump every week, and his response was, well, I could. I mean, there's always material there.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, I think all of us in the media, we caught on too late to the idea that Trump was taking massive advantage of the fact that he was such good copy. And part of that was because a lot of people in the news business didn't take him seriously as a candidate. We thought this was just like a lark, like it was, you know, an entertaining sideshow that would eventually peter out, and then the quote-unquote real candidate would emerge. And by the time, you know, people realized that wasn't the case, he had already basically won the race, I think.
He was treated like the halftime show instead of the actual football game.
Exactly, exactly. And Trump was the first person to understand that there wasn't a distinction between the halftime show and the football game. And he was smarter than all of us in that respect.
Here's a call from Gene. I don't see the town in California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matt Taibbi.
Hi.
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 I was wondering if a news outlet or could just refuse to cover things like lies, like if NPR, if I support NPR and I don't want to hear things that aren't news, and lies aren't news, can they just set a standard and not cover it?
I would say, from my own perspective, working for an NPR affiliate, no, we don't have that choice. We're covering the President of the United States now. Matt, what are your thoughts?
It's pretty tough to consciously decide not to cover something. And, you know, what you're saying is I don't want to hear that if it's not true. And so that gets into the whole consumer aspect of how our business works. If enough of our viewers don't want to hear it, then what's going to end up happening is we're not going to cover it. But the reality is, you know, as reporters, we're trained, if the President of the United States lies about something, we're obligated to cover it, especially if it's something that's really incredibly newsworthy. I mean, I don't think the size of his crowds is newsworthy, but if he gets out there and he says, you know, there's no problem with affordable health care in this country, well, we have to cover that, and we have to counter that, and we should, I think.
Another call here from Steve in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi.
Hi.
Basically, I had two quick things. One, my observation is that the Republicans tend to take to the polls and get organized where there is, quote, unquote, liberals tend to take to the street, which we seem to be observing now. And then the other thing is that I saw on the net this morning that Trump has frozen all climate-related research and has directed federal personnel not to communicate on unauthorized manner. Basically, they can communicate inside the agencies, but cannot issue any information outside.
Yeah, he's essentially gagged the EPA. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right,
yeah.
Thanks for that, Steve.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think your first observation about the organizing versus the protesting, you know, there's something to that. I think there's more of a tendency on the conservative side to get behind a leader. They're less focused on individuality and expressing themselves. Whereas I've been to protests before, particularly anti-war protests, where you would see things on the flyers ahead of time encouraging the marchers to dress outlandishly and to you know, show your individuality. I think the mindset on the other side is the opposite, and maybe that's part of the reason that they've been more effective.
Yeah, you know, it's not like you ever pull punches in your writing, Matt, but there's a phrase in here about this election being an ongoing moronic referendum on white victimhood. Do you think it was going to be that after 8 years of Obama, no matter what, on the Republican side?
Yeah, of course, of course. And I think Trump, look, all elections are ultimately referenda on race, or they have been for quite some time, you know, since Richard Nixon's Southern Strategy, which was really consciously directed at the resentments of people who didn't fully agree with the civil rights movement. He targeted, you know, the quote-unquote silent majority. And, you know, there have been a succession of politicians who have been after that big block of votes. And Trump was just the latest, although he was more overt about it. You know, I think he he did that, and after the Obama administration, he captured the resentments. But I still think the Democrats had an opportunity to counter that, because the size of their coalition victories in the last two elections should have been big enough to be a counter to that. So I don't think that explains why he won 100%. I think it's just a big factor.
Well, that gets us back to not just the Democrats, but the Republicans as well, and how they felt about after what happened after the 2012 election, with this postmortem that the Republican Party did after the loss by Mitt Romney, where they realized, you know, we're in trouble demographically down the road, because there will be more people who are naturally Democrats down the road, fewer white people, more people of color down the road. Did the Democrats, you think, assumed that Democratic advantage would lead them to victory?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that was part of their thinking. That, you know, there was a story in the New York Times very early in the election cycle, I think in like the spring of 2015, which was full of sort of anonymous quotes from inside the Clinton campaign. And what the story basically said is the Democrats, well, we would like to run a different campaign, like the one we ran in 1996, where we targeted, Southern white men, you know, and sort of working class white people. But they're running a different campaign. They're going after the quote unquote Obama strategy, which was based upon minorities and special interest groups. And clearly, Barack Obama was a unique political figure. I think he galvanized people in a way that you couldn't just repeat through a formula. And I think the Democrats were naive in thinking that anybody could replicate that that just anybody could do that, particularly Hillary Clinton, who ran the opposite strategy when she first ran in 2008. So, I think they made a mistake. I think they assumed they had all those votes in pocket and that they would know it carry them to victory.
Well, but then there's so many little things that could have added up late in the game, particularly the James Comey thing. I noticed Paul Krugman from the New York Times yesterday tweeting about the president being mentally ill and wrote, "Thanks, Comey," at the end of it. I mean, how significant do you think that was?
I mean, it's all significant. All of it mattered. But the problem was that, you know, Donald Trump, he shouldn't have been within 10 million votes of winning the election. If the Democrats are saying, "Oh, we would have won except for this little thing or that little thing," they're not. What they should be doing is they should be sitting down and saying, "My God, how did we lose a popularity contest to this person who offended basically every single demographic group in America, including women?" So it wasn't just he didn't openly insult white men, but he had a natural disadvantage demographically with everybody, and he had proved repeatedly that he wasn't really qualified to be president. I think any candidate who was a little bit more of a novelty and didn't have that long record in politics at a time when people wanted something new would have beaten Trump by an enormous margin. And for the Democrats to not be alarmed by the result is alarming itself, I think.
Another call here from, looks like, Cheryl in Klamath Falls. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, this is Cheryl, and hello, both of you.
Hi.
Hi.
Trump partnered up with the Ecumenicals, and I thought there was something about dividing church and state. And how did the Ecumenicals feel now that he lies? That he puts violence on some people that need to get their research out.
Okay, I think the term you're looking for, Charles, is evangelical. And let's get a read from Matt on this.
Sure. Well, evangelicals supported Trump by, you know, a 4-1 margin. So he got 80% of the evangelical vote. So that tells you, and that's despite the fact that Trump clearly isn't himself a religious person, that he's said in the past that he was pro-choice. They had a very he had an uphill climb with evangelicals in the primary race, but the fact that they selected Trump 4-1 over Hillary Clinton, again, I think Democrats should look at that number and just think to themselves, "My God, what are we doing wrong?" You know, and we have to find a new way to communicate with people.
So in the age we live in now, I've often thought that Abraham Lincoln would not stand a chance in the TV age. And you mentioned in the book, too, that Mozarts and Einsteins don't run for president. I mean, what do you think the chance would be of somebody like Lincoln today?
Well, the problem with somebody like Lincoln is that Lincoln would not get the financial support of the people who normally sponsor the candidates, because Lincoln probably, his politics probably would have been a little bit too radical for the people who dictate normally who gets to run for president and who doesn't. I think if Lincoln was independently wealthy, like Donald Trump was, and was able to run a campaign, his own campaign, I think he would actually do all right. Americans are shallow, but it's not all about looks. I think certainly Donald Trump proved that. I think he would have done fine. It's the money that's the issue, and that's usually been the barrier to the intelligent candidate who's trying to break through.
Finally, Matt, you see the political system as sick and broken. Is it more so, you think, than at other periods in American history when we've reached low ebbs in our political life?
Oh, I'm relatively young. I mean, I'm in my 40s, and I haven't been around long enough to know if it's been worse. But certainly in my lifetime, I don't think it's ever been more broken than this. I definitely worry, especially as someone. I lived in Russia after the collapse of communism, and when things start to fall apart, it can happen really quickly, and we have to worry about that.
All right. Matt Taibbi's book is called Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. My apologies to the people waiting online. We got lots of calls. Can't get them all in. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks so much, Jim. Appreciate
Take it, it easy.